I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Philadelphia is beefing up its election fraud task force to keep an eye on polling places amid charges of fraud and the possibility of intimidation. Donald Trump has suggested that the election in Pennsylvania could be rigged if he loses in November because of voting malfeasance in this city.
You've got to go out and you've got to get your friends and you've got to get everybody you know. And you got to watch your polling booths, because I hear too many stories about Pennsylvania, certain areas. I hear too many bad stories, and we can't lose an election because of you know what I'm talking about. So go and vote and then go check out areas, because a lot of bad things happen. And we don't want to lose for that reason. We don't want to lose, but we don't want to lose for that reason. So go over and watch carefully, because we're going to win the state of Pennsylvania.
Donald Trump at a rally in Manheim, Pennsylvania on October 1st. We asked Ryan Godfrey to join us. He's an elections inspector for District 46, Ward 17 in West Philadelphia. And he wrote a piece in Vox telling Trump to stop charging that there's vote rigging in Philadelphia. He's a software product manager and joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Ryan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's really great to be here. Thanks.
Nice to have you with us. And what does an elections inspector do?
Sure. So it's an elected position. I was elected by people in my neighborhood. I had to take petitions around mostly to my neighbors and people in a few blocks around me. And it's one of three elected positions in the division. There's the judge of elections and then two inspectors. The inspectors are primarily the majority inspector is generally of the majority party, which is also matches the judge of elections. The minority inspector is generally not of that party, and that's what I am in this case. So we act as kind of a check and balance on the other people in the division election officials board.
And you told me that you're an independent. You've
that's right.
Voted. Various different ways, but largely think of yourself as an independent.
I think of myself as an independent, right, that occasionally will vote in a primary, either for a Republican or for a Democrat.
You got interested and involved when there were questions raised about 2012 and the fact that Mitt Romney and some of these precincts in Philadelphia got zero votes. And some people said, aha, an example of some kind of malfeasance. That's what got you involved, and tell us why.
Well, I saw that. The Philadelphia Inquirer did a story shortly after the election in 2012 and found these 59 divisions with no Romney votes. And that made a few headlines and got a few people interested. A lot of the interest came from Republicans who didn't know Philadelphia very well. So you got a lot of, you know, sort of talk show hosts and you know, Fox News contributors saying that there were some problems here without really necessarily knowing our city. I saw this as an opportunity for me to not necessarily say anything definitive about the city of Philadelphia, but just to help my community make sure that elections go smoothly, make sure that you know, all the votes are counted accurately. And, you know, as a software person, I've been very interested in the numbers and the data and the stats. So this was a nice mesh for me between sort of data nerdery and, and, you know, patriotism, essentially.
Data nerdery and patriotism. I like that combination. But does it make sense to you that there could have been district or precincts, I should say, in or wards in Philadelphia where Mitt Romney got zero votes?
It actually does. It makes a lot of sense. Unfortunately, our city is still fairly segregated. So we've got a lot of divisions in the city, and there's 1,687 different divisions where it's very possible that there are no Republicans. You can look at voting counts from previous, you know, from the primary, from 2008, go back to these same divisions, and see that there aren't actually any Republicans who live here. This is primarily the areas we're talking about are predominantly African-American, predominantly poor, and it's really easy to imagine that there weren't that many people who would be able to see Mitt Romney and say, yeah, that's the guy who's going to vote. I'm going to vote for, given the historical nature of Barack Obama's candidacy.
Can people voting in the city trust the machines? And I ask that because I remember in 2000 or the early 2000s questions about the Diebold machines,
right,
and some kind of a potential association with Republicans. How about the machines here in Philadelphia?
We don't use those Diebold machines. We use something called the electronic, which the elect is all caps, so you can tell that it's about voting. And it was kind of requisitioned in the 90s. They put it in place in the 2000s. And it's using a much different technology. The machines themselves are kind of – it's actually 80s technology that they're using inside the machines.
80s technology.
Yeah.
Which is maybe a good thing?
In this case, it's probably a good thing. These machines can't be networked. They cannot be – you can't plug in your USB drive into the thing and change the code. You actually have to break a lot of numbered seals to get into the back of the machine. Even to open the machine in the morning, you have to break a lot of numbered seals. But specifically to get into the back of it, to do anything to the code. To my knowledge, there have been researchers who have tried to, hack this with having machine and having the, access to the back of the machine. And to my knowledge, no one has ever fully been able to change votes in the machine such that, it was undetectable.
Let me quote Lisa Dealey. She had a piece in the Inquirer today, a Philadelphia City Commissioner. She said, each voting machine is a standalone closed system that is not connected to any other machine, device, or the internet, does not contain any wireless capabilities whatsoever. And she goes on from there, sort of underscoring what you're saying there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. These machines, if you were to be able to hack them and get into them, you'd have to do that on an individual basis. You'd have to have access to every machine physically and basically to be able to tear it apart to get inside of it to do anything. Unless you're, a member of the government, you're not going to have access to this. Of course, if you're a member of the government, there are much easier ways to get the votes that you need to make this happen. So it would be very difficult for a massive conspiracy to take over the voting machines here and not have people notice that.
And what about the allegations, the charges that people are going to go to the polls impersonating somebody else, maybe voting multiple times? Based on your observations and experiences, what's your response to that?
Sure. Well, Philadelphia is a city of neighborhoods. My neighborhood, my voting area is about, 8 blocks, something like that. So these are people that I know and see. We go to the same restaurants and we hang out in the parks. Our kids probably go to school together. And this is the same all over Philadelphia. If you are voting in a Philadelphia voting division, it's very likely that you're going to see people that you know in the room where the voting is happening. And honestly, good luck, coming in there and trying to convince either me or my other, voting officials or your fellow voters that you're somebody that you aren't. It's really unlikely. And if you manage to do it, if for some reason you're going to impersonate somebody and then pretend to vote for them, you've managed to get one extra vote. And it's not going to steal election by any means.
And what about the training for people that work at your poll?
Sure. Every year we have there's poll worker training. It's basically short and sweet. It doesn't go too long. It's basically to refresh your memory about how the machines work, remind you of the rules about what happens when the voting opens, how you have to hang the signs, that kind of thing. We'll get some reminders about if there is anything untoward or suspicious, to numbers that we can call. We're issued a phone by the city that we can use for any problems that occur.
And what about for poll watchers? What are the rules and regulations for people who, quote unquote, are watching the polls?
Sure. In Pennsylvania, you have to be a member of the county that you want to be a poll watcher in. So that means that you have to be a Philadelphia resident in this case to watch the polls in Philadelphia, at least to get a certificate from the city saying that you're going to be a poll watcher.
And is that typical at your election spot? Are there generally watchers, poll watchers?
Yes. We typically see Democratic committee people more than actual Republicans. We'll occasionally see Republicans, but honestly, it's a fairly small amount of Republican poll watchers traditionally in the city. I think last I saw there were about 200 signed up in a city of 1,687 divisions. So they have a lot of work to do and are not necessarily going to show up at every division or stay very long.
So what do you make of Donald Trump? And he's said this multiple times about Pennsylvania. He talks about communities, obviously referring to Philadelphia and probably some other urban areas that have diverse populations. Mm-hmm. What do you think he's trying to do and say? I mean, we know what he's saying, but what is he saying?
I think he's saying that he wants people who are his supporters to hang out in Philadelphia and these other urban areas. And I actually don't really know what his motive or his method is there, or what he wants his people to do. He says, you know what to do. And to me, without him having made that clear, I think people are going to come to their own conclusions. And I don't know what those conclusions will be.
Do you think there's a concern it could depress the voter turnout?
Certainly could depress the voter turnout. It certainly somebody could show up and try and intimidate people, keep them out of the voting booth entirely. That's something I'm worried about.
One of the things you wrote about in Vox was when you were a poll watcher, you actually did see some workers adding some votes to a machine.
Oh, it wasn't me. It was there was a poll watcher in the Northeast, I believe, who happened to see some elections officials. They had a vote count that was wrong, so they had six more people who had come in to sign the roll book than they actually had votes. So that's not unusual if the vote count is off by one or two. In this case, it was off by six, which meant somebody wasn't probably paying that much attention during the day. And they ended up actually going in and just adding votes to the machine at the end of the election to make sure that, the vote count matched the vote tally of people. And a poll watcher actually saw that and reported them, and they were prosecuted last year for that. So it was, kind of a stupid thing to do. And it's okay if your vote count doesn't match successfully, just leave it at that. Don't try to take it into your own hands. I mean, it wasn't even clear that they were trying to, add votes for a particular candidate or anything like that. They were just
match the numbers.
Just
somehow
matching numbers.
So what do you do? We're almost out of time here, but what do you do to gear up for Election Day? You personally?
Drinking a lot of coffee helps. It's about a 14-hour day. So fortunately, my division takes place in a coffee shop. So there's the coffee is easy to access and definitely easy to get to. And I'm drinking a lot of it most of the day. But other than that, it's basically just getting excited, talking to my neighbors, getting them excited, and looking forward to seeing everybody on Election Day.
Well, I appreciate you coming in and telling us what you do. Ryan Godfrey, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's Inspector of Elections for District 46, Ward 17 in West Philadelphia. We're going to take a very short break, and we've got two guests waiting in the wings. We will carry on our conversation talking about allegations of fraud, of intimidation, and what to make of election 2016. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. A new poll from PRRI found that a significant number of Americans are not sure their vote will count in November. Apparently, young people are the least confident. There are a number of reasons for this anxiety: allegations of fraud, acts of voter suppression, the influence of money in our electoral system, gerrymandering, and this year, Russian hackers. We have two guests who have joined us to carry on this conversation. David Wilson joining us by telephone. He's a professor of political science and psychological and brain sciences at the University of Delaware. He's published research examining public opinion toward voter ID laws, electoral malfeasance, and racial attitudes. David Wilson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. On here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Lorraine Maniti. She's a professor of public policy at Rutgers University in Camden, wrote a book called The Myth of Voter Fraud in about 6 years ago, and she publishes on political participation, immigration, voting behavior and urban politics. Lorraine, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. David, this is certainly not the first year or certainly the first time on Radio Times that we've talked about a certain level of suspicion about voting and allegations of fraud and even voter anxiety. Do you think there's something unique about this year?
No, this is pretty common. The first thing we have to know about these kinds of comments is that they're very intentional and they're very strategic. And you normally hear things like, we're going to win, we still have a chance, even when a candidate is clearly behind in the polls. And what's unique about the language here, usually in the past you might say, well, you know, we may have concerns about things related to like the 2000 election and what may be happening with machines. But the comments this year are specifically about something being intentionally falsified in the system. The system is against a particular candidate. And so when you hear those kinds of comments that are directly targeting the system, the democracy, the electoral process, the media, the federal government, the polls, people start to put it all together in one bundle of distrust. And it seems to be targeting our democratic system. And that's what's different this year.
Well, Lorraine, your book came out in what, the 2010, so 6 years ago, entitled The Myth of Voter Fraud. And yet here we are talking about allegations of voter fraud. Why are we still having this conversation?
Well, I think that allegations of voter fraud are now part of the political process. And for some of the reasons David was just mentioning, they can have an effect in terms of shifting public opinion, for example, to support things like voter ID laws or raising questions about the legitimacy of the election to get people perhaps motivated or demotivated. We don't know. It could go either direction. But I think that we're hearing it again because it's almost become hardwired in the political discourse with the level of polarization and party conflict that we're seeing and the divisions in the country. And, you know, a lot of big issues about changes in American society are making a lot of people very anxious. And I think that that's why we're seeing it again.
Well, and David, picking up on something that you seem to allude to, and perhaps this speaks to where things stand for Donald Trump these days, is this something that someone says when they fear they are going to lose, or he fears he's going to lose his race?
Well, typically there are kind of comments that people use to try and distract from the fact that they may be losing. No one wants to quit with a couple of weeks left to go in the election. But what's unique about this year is that there's this kind of idea of a common enemy. Trump is, you know, he's kind of pitting himself against his party. He's pitting himself against the government, the Republicans, everybody who supports Hillary Clinton. And so this idea of a common enemy is a strategic ploy to create an us versus them. And once the fear kicks in, all you do is continue to ramp up that narrative that someone is trying to take us out or something is trying to take us out and destroy what we have. And that makes people very protective and defensive. And they start to believe things that are associated with the idea of corruption.
Do you think there's some coded language here, Lorraine, when there's talk about cities or there's some other kind of language that's being used to talk about where the alleged problem is?
Yes, I definitely do. I think that's part of what I was exploring in my book. I was trying to understand the huge gulf between the number and volume of allegations and the actual evidence that we were able to find of voter fraud. And so why people think this? And when, in fact, the facts suggest it's not a problem at all. And that got me into thinking about the ways in which the language taps into racial attitudes, for example, urban associated with minorities, associated with corruption for some people. And so you could sort of communicate a story by using this language, and you didn't really have to say, oh, it's those black folks in Philadelphia are going to steal the election, because that's just not acceptable to say that. So we have this other narrative about the electoral system being vulnerable to kind of corruption.
David, it's so interesting because when you look at the facts, if we're talking about voter impersonation, someone pretending that they're someone else in order to vote, that the evidence of that is just so minuscule, isn't even a small enough word to describe the actual evidence of that. And yet this narrative continues.
Yeah. Well, Lorraine's work is very important in this area. The idea of the myth of voter fraud is really raising the suspicion itself. Once you've raised the suspicion, then anyone who has to explain or give details about why it doesn't occur is getting into the weeds now. Now you're getting into nuance, and that takes a lot of attention on the part of any person who's out there in the electorate. And so if you've got someone who's already against a particular candidate or in an opposition party, then going through that explanation to say, these little instances were just kind of explainable very easily, that takes a lot of effort on the part of the individual. And so all you have to do is raise the specter of it, and then you've kind of already opened the door that it might be possible, because people have to then defend it and explain it.
So by having this conversation, David, we're feeding this narrative of voter fraud?
Unfortunately, that's exactly right. We have to have the conversation to explain it, and now we're being judged rather than the comment itself, right? So instead of us saying, well, hey, this comment doesn't make any sense on the surface, people are like, but they said it. They must be saying it for some reason. Status quo always gets kind of the benefit of the doubt. It's the strange thing that you have to kind of explain and deal with.
So how should we be talking about this?
No, I think we have to have the conversation. There are just consequences that come with that, right? So it is a conversation that's going to take you'd hope that evidence really matters, that facts really matters. But people are motivated to believe certain things. They selectively filter out some pieces of information more than others. They give weight to other kinds of information more than facts sometimes. But you have to still have the conversation, because there's some people that do want the facts out there.
Lorraine, you want to add to that?
Yes. I mean, I think we want to be optimistic and hope that rationality and reason minds will hear, this conversation as well, and have people think about what might be actually going on, given the evidence that maybe we can bring to the discussion. Most people don't know what goes into administering an election, the complexities, the procedures, the rules, what checks are in place. And for most people, you just go to your polling place, you wait in line, maybe you check in, you pull, sometimes you have to learn how to use the equipment, but you cast your ballot and you pretty much hope, you assume, I think most people probably assume, most people assume that it's counted, but nobody knows what goes on behind the closed doors when the election administrators are doing their work. So it's not something that's very transparent to people. And therefore, it's a black box.
And you're not given that receipt like you might at your
right.
bank, right? Where you
right.
can say, I voted and here's the
here's
the evidence.
Exactly. You're not given something that you can say, hey, this I did this and I want to check and make sure my ballot was counted. There's no follow-up for the individual voter to know that.
Just picking up on that, David, and then I do want to get some callers in. Using this example, and perhaps we're feeding this narrative, but if someone were to rig a national election, an election for president, I mean, how would you do that, knowing how decentralized everything is? I was just talking to a inspector of elections here in Philadelphia. There are 1,600 polling places in Philadelphia.
I kind of chuckled. I'm like this is like a movie or something. I can't imagine in the United States that with all the scrutiny, with all the social media, with all the checks and balances, with the parties, with the heightened attention to this, that it would be possible for it to happen. There would have to be some really well-coordinated effort. Somebody's going to slip up along the way. They'll be drinking out in the bar one night, and they'll just tell it to the person next to them. There's no way that a national election could be stolen. Now, the PTA election or the dog catcher election or, school boards, those kinds of things, you may be able to kind of, get out the vote with donuts and pizza and paying people off. But it's hard to do a national or even a statewide election rig it, much less kind of help somebody win without anybody else voting on the other side. So.
And that's David Wilson. He's a professor of political science and psychological brain sciences at the University of Delaware, joining us by telephone. Lorraine Menidi is with us here in our Philadelphia studio. She's a professor of public policy at Rutgers University, their Camden campus, wrote a book called The Myth of Voter Fraud. And we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. A lot of comments as well, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at whyyradiotimes. Let me get Matt from Glenside to join us. Hi, Matt. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much. I love your show.
Thank you.
So just two things that I was telling your caller screener before is one comment about the media and its coverage of the election. And unfortunately, I'm afraid I feel like NPR has been guilty of this as well. And that is whenever they're doing a story on the election, it's always either or, either the Republican or the Democrat. And unless they're doing a story specifically about a third-party candidate, there's never a comment they never conclude the story with, you know, that there are multiple options available. And so I feel like it just really gets, it makes it as though there are no other options. And at this point in the game, there probably aren't any other options, but that could have been a different story, I think, if the coverage had been different nationally.
And your other point, Matt? Yeah, because I do want to keep us on voting and
sure,
voting
sure.
Integrity.
The other one is I actually was convicted of voter fraud in the state of Kentucky in the 90s.
Wow.
And ended up having to do 100 hours of community service. And what happened was I was I had moved shortly before the elections, and both the new district I was in and the old district I had moved from were holding their the elections were being held in a school gym. And I went up to the table that I was supposed to go up to with my new address, and they said, "Oh, we don't have you on our rolls here." And I thought, "Oh, I just went to the wrong table." I went to the other one, which was my old district, signed in and voted, and you know, like 6 weeks later, got a letter about voting in the wrong district as voter fraud.
Wow.
So make sure you're voting in the right
absolutely,
district.
No question about it, Matt. I have to say Lorraine is kind of shaking her head here. Go ahead, Lorraine.
Well, I think that's really not an example of voter fraud. There, I think you want to make a distinction between fraud and, say, illegal voting, and that would be maybe in your case where you voted in the wrong precinct. That might have just been a fact, but the question is whether you intentionally did that, you were trying to deceive election officials, and in fact, from my perspective, you're kind of a victim of the complexity of the electoral system. And the fact that voters can be confused, it's completely understandable that voters get confused because the rules are about, you know, stuff that people don't pay a lot of attention to. And so I wouldn't even call that a case of voter fraud. You weren't, from what you just said, you weren't intentionally trying to, you know, game the system there.
It sounds like you want to add something, David. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it just speaks to the point that here in the United States, we don't make voting very easily. We make it actually pretty complex. And in the nation that we're the guiding star of democracy, and we have these democratic values, but yet voting becomes this very kind of cumbersome process of making sure we're following the exact rules. Now that's not to say that shouldn't be, but it just speaks to the idea that, you know, something that was not intentional, someone just wanted to do their civic duty, got convicted. So you're definitely a victim in all of this.
What do you then make of, David, voter ID laws? Now, certainly, I mean, Pennsylvania is an interesting example in that there was an effort to have voter ID, went to court. Apparently, the state didn't have one single evidence of voter impersonation. Nonetheless, the state went through some pretty serious soul searching about whether one can rely on the veracity of our electoral system. What then do you make of these voter ID laws? And of course, they're across the country.
Yeah, I think the research among, at least from political scientists and some economists now, are pretty certain that, you know, these things are motivated by underlying competitive elections where Democrats have won. Public support for these laws are motivated by racial sentiments about outgroups voting in larger numbers. So the idea of voter ID laws may they're actually pretty highly supported across the board by minorities, non-minorities, Democrats, liberals. All of them support in majority form. They seem very benign in their idea. But the actual process of getting a government-issued photograph, signatured ID is actually not as easy as many people think, you know, and where you can get them from and when they have to be validated and by who and what distance before the election takes place. So I think the research has shown that these things are strategic and political and not necessarily trying to solve a problem per se.
Do you see them as a form of voter suppression?
I do.
You
yes.
do? How about for you, Lorraine?
Yes, I think I agree with David completely that, you know, what we our goal should be really to create an electoral system that doesn't get in the way of people who want to vote. Citizens who are eligible, who want to vote, should not be thwarted because they can't comply with a rule. And that's part of the problem with the ID laws. And as David said, they have support because most people have a driver's license in the United States. So, you know, you sort of think, could I comply with this? Yeah, hey, that's very easy. This sounds like a good idea. It's not about the most of us. It's about a minority of people, and these are poor people in most cases, who have great difficulty. They are not flying on planes. They don't own cars. They are struggling to survive. And to get that specific ID when, in fact, we could accept other kinds of ID that they might have is the issue. And, you know, why don't we do that? That's the question I think we want to have about our electoral system and the rules that we put in place to make it harder for some people to vote.
Another ID, like a utility bill?
Right. It could be something like that a person might have, something that they needed, maybe a letter addressed to them from a government office if they're receiving social services or something. Or at the very least, and I can tell you this, that in no state that has adopted a voter photo ID law, in no state, in any legislature, were there any presentation of any evidence that voter fraud was a problem? And there were no efforts in most places, or maybe a few exceptions, but in most places, there were no good faith efforts, really, to make sure that everybody had the ID before the law got put in place. So that tells you what photo ID laws are about.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoing, talking with Lorraine Menitti. She's a professor of public policy at Rutgers University. Their Camden campus wrote a book called The Myth of Voter Fraud. David Wilson joining us by telephone, professor of political science and psychological and brain sciences at the University of Delaware. And you can join our conversation. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. David, there's a lot of talk about inspectors or people, poll watchers, people coming to watch other people vote. What are some of the laws about that, and when does watching become intimidation?
Well, I can't actually speak to the laws because they kind of vary state to state. There are some expectations about, you know, free and fair elections. But the irony in having the watchers there and the comments that are being used, specifically by Donald Trump in this case, is that he is referring to the instances in Philadelphia in 2012 or 8, I can't recall. Lorraine may be able to help me out with that.
I think it was 2008.
2008, yeah, where you had the members of the Black Panther movement or party there sensibly intimidating voters, and they were sensibly watching the election, or I'm not sure what they were doing. The Justice Department looked into it, found no ultimate wrongdoing, no criminal conviction from what I can recall. But now they're asking people to watch in the same way that they had a problem with the individuals in the past. So I don't really understand the intent behind that, other than to stoke some notion of identity or connection with the candidate, that we're going to rally around some cause here. And I don't get it. I don't think it's very good for democracy either.
You want to speak to that, Lorraine?
I think, as David mentioned, all states have rules about poll watching. And as you heard from your first guest, Ryan Gottfried, the inspector, There are a lot of rules about how that works, and usually it's very limited, maybe one person or two people in the polling place. They have a role. They're allowed to do certain things. They're allowed to observe. And I don't necessarily really object to that when all the procedures are followed. So, you know, your question about how does it go from watching to intimidation,
yeah.
I think the intimidation could happen if people don't understand that there are rules for poll watching and they just show up. And they mob the polling places, or they go walk around trying to take pictures of people and things like that. That's not acceptable. And again, most states also have rules about how close you can get to the polling place, who's allowed inside, who's allowed to talk to voters when they're waiting in line. All those rules are there for a reason. Then that is to make people feel comfortable and not intimidated by what might happen by having a lot of, say, you know, followers of one candidate kind of going and trying to disrupt or intimidate voters while they're waiting to vote.
And do we know the impact? Go ahead, David.
Can I just say it real quick? I mean, the danger in this is that if a confrontation occurs, right, and something happens, then the whole thing becomes tainted and corrupted, right? They could actually have to close down a polling station if people, you know, violence breaks out or a confrontation happens that spills into the polling station, and the people are arguing outside, and it becomes something that distracts from the idea of voting, and people can't actually vote. So having people show up there, all it takes is one person on either side to argue, and their friends jump into it. So it's just a really dangerous slope to have kind of informal watchers at polling stations.
Let me read a couple of emails. One from Glenn. Computer security experts have been warning for years that electronic voting machines are not secure. Any significant movement to require voter-verified paper ballots? And again, we spoke to this earlier, Lorraine, and people just, they want to be able to walk out the door with something that said, my vote, counted.
Yes, I mean, I do favor something where we can be sure that if we have to recount the election, that we have those ballots. So, you know, there are paper ballots that are read by computers, for example, and that just helps with the counting. But you have that record, and there's proper procedures for storing them so you can do a recount if you need it. I think there certainly is continued pressure. There are a few places in the country still that use machines and don't issue any kind of paper record of that, and I don't think that's a good idea.
Let me read an email from Marisol talking about her 22-year-old daughter with special needs, very excited to be voting for the first time this year, and then she had questions about assistance and how to get into the voting booth. My suggestion to anyone listening is to go to the Committee of 70. They are one of the watchdog groups here in Philadelphia. If there are any questions that people have, I would direct them that way. There's also the city commissioners. They're involved in elections and trying to make sure that everything runs smoothly.
Yes, I think that's a good idea, good recommendation, and that folks who might have any difficulty voting can, you know, check ahead and check out what the rules are. Maybe different in New Jersey and Delaware and Pennsylvania, but you certainly should be allowed to have assistance in the polling place.
Let me get, looks like Mason from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Hi, Mason. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey there. Yeah, you guys started off the conversation talking about how you know, young people feel particularly disenfranchised in this election, or like their votes don't count, and as if that's, you
is
know,
that you?
All up to. I am. Well, I'm 27 and I live in Philly, and for the first time, I actually feel like my vote does count because I live in a swing state now, but I grew up in Georgia, and I have a lot of friends there that are, you know, similarly pretty progressive like me, and have for a long time felt like their votes don't really count and are pretty discouraged to go out and vote because it's so obvious it's going to be a red state. So I feel like there's always this jump to be like, you know, oh, people assume that, you know, Russian hackers or there must be fraud or that's what people are thinking. But the reality is for, you know, the exception of a very few states, Pennsylvania being one of them, people a lot of times don't really feel like their votes count if you're in the political minority in those states and don't feel very encouraged to go out and vote.
Well, Mason, let me see what David Wilson says in response to that. Just this sense that the system, not whether it's rigged or not, but just the system doesn't really reflect what they want to say and do.
Yeah, I think that's unfortunate. But, you know, I think that I want to put a plug in for majoring in political science. And you've learned the value of kind of civic engagement and actually the agency you get from participating in politics in general. But this is exactly what some people want folks to do. There are many kind of ways you can look at a democracy and who should be participating in a democracy. And there are some theories out there about that not everyone should be able to participate. I mean, you already see this, that, you know, felons, for example, are disenfranchised in many states, people who have criminal convictions, you know, there are all kind of rules for people who cannot vote. So there are some people who believe that we should try and discourage those people who are not willing to endure all of these things to vote. And so there are many Republicans in Democratic states that say, yes, that's exactly what I want people to do. In the other states, they don't vote. Hopefully, we'll gain a critical mass and we'll be able to have an impact. But I would encourage everybody, of course, to think about the broader idea of democratic values, and the reason why we live in this country and we value it so much is because we have the opportunity to vote.
Mason, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Lorraine, looks like you want to add something.
I wanted to point out, I understand that completely. There's a sort of contradiction with voting where, you know, you do it by yourself, you're all alone, it's your one vote, and then you look at the outcome and you say, hey, you know, it doesn't really matter what I do. But of course, you could say that in a major election, you could say that anyway. It doesn't, you know, in some ways, one vote, your one vote is not going to determine the outcome. So it's kind of irrational.
Yeah.
But the point really more is that what matters is what happens collectively, and the way that, you know, voting can be just one thing that you do in your civic engagement, your effort to kind of engage in the politics of the country and push your issues and work with other people. And I want to echo exactly what David said about, you know, the system sets up these ways in which you might become frustrated, but you have to, you know, remember all the civil rights heroes and how hard, you know, what happened. How many people really struggled for the right to vote in this country? It's got to be made meaningful by the rest of us.
David, there, I was reading actually in the paper today some concerns that they're not just potential violence at polling places, but that there won't be a peaceful transfer of power, that whoever wins, whoever loses, that the tradition of sort of handing off from one person to the next will somehow be undone by this election. Do you share those concerns?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to see that playing out. Well, the peaceful transition across parties, I'm sure Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama would have a relatively peaceful transition. But, you know, when you have, you know, a candidate like Donald Trump questioning the legitimacy of Barack Obama's presidency, and then Barack Obama, sensibly, if Trump wins, having to peacefully and just accept, he's pretty good at it, but it'd be pretty difficult to just kind of say, I don't believe you should be president, but I have to take a step back from my own personal beliefs and hand this over, and to see how Donald Trump would receive that. It's I don't know that we've seen that in modern times. So
yeah, well, I mean, it sounds like you're saying you're not questioning that Barack Obama won't give him the keys to the White House.
No, he'll give him the keys. It's just, you know, it'll be kind of tense, and so they'll probably be the most watched transition of power ever to see if anything actually happens. I mean, it's not just two people; it's actually their families, the staffs. It's a, you know, it's, it could be interesting if it happens.
Lorraine, you want to add to that?
I think there is a lot of concern about what Donald Trump's comments about rigged elections and how he won't accept the outcomes. You're going to make us wait in suspense to find out. Are very troubling. And I see, you know, there are leaders in the Republican Party who feel this way, too. And I think the reason is that they understand this is about the institutions of the country. It's not just about individuals and personalities. It's about the presidency. It's about the stability of the American democracy that could be at stake. So there are concerns about that kind of rhetoric causing people to really not accept the results, especially if Donald Trump wins. And I think that is the reason why he keeps saying, you know, the election's going to be rigged, because he's worried that he's going to lose.
We've got Bernie, it looks like. Bernie from East Kensington joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Bernie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I think the idea of voting machines providing a printed receipt that you voted and who you voted for is an extremely bad idea, because it opens up the likelihood of people who will offer to buy receipts. Say, I'll pay $20 or $10 for any receipt that shows that you voted for candidate X.
But Bernie, this is after someone voted. Who would buy that? Why would they buy that?
No, after the all right. So suppose I want candidate X to win, and I want people to vote for candidate X. I can offer prior to the election, I can say, anybody who brings me a receipt showing they voted for candidate X, I will give $10 to. That will increase, that will cause people to vote for that candidate who want to make those $10, and they bring me the receipts and I pay them later. But this is really a bad idea.
Well, you know, Bernie, hold on. Let me give Lorraine a chance to respond.
I think I know what Bernie is getting at, but I think the folks who advocate for the receipts are talking about just a receipt saying that you voted.
Right.
I mean, there are laws in place really about the secret ballot that, you know, we can't. You're not even supposed to reveal who you voted to somebody else in some states. There are rules around that. So I think, you know, I understand what you're saying, and you're talking about vote buying.
Yeah.
And the secret ballot, in fact, is one of the reforms put in place that really kind of got rid of a lot of that vote buying, because the vote buyers could not be ensured that the people they paid actually voted for the candidate that they wanted them to vote for. So the secret ballot is a protection against vote buying.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. One of the decisions or incidents that gets pointed to a lot is Bush v. Gore. And the fact that Florida obviously was this hotbed of controversy and allegations. The press originally announced that Bush had won. Gore conceded. Then the press took back the results. Gore took back his congratulations. There was a call for a recount. The court intervened. The Supreme Court intervened and stopped the recount. And finally, Bush was declared the victor, even though I think Gore got about 500,000 more votes. Is this a good example, Lorraine, to point to? And David, I want to hear from you as well. I mean, it's so unique to 2000, it seems.
Well, I mean, what you saw there, until the Supreme Court basically stopped the recount, what you saw was the way a close election would unfold in many places, because states have rules about automatic recounts when the results are that close. And that's a good thing, that we want to recount the ballots and be sure when there's such a small margin. So that was understandable. That wasn't Al Gore questioning the integrity of the election. He kind of followed through on the procedures, given the information that he had. And the fact then that a recount would happen. In some places, it's automatic if it's within a particular percentage of a difference.
David, I'm sorry, only because I'm watching the clock. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I mean, that this is you know, kind of watching the process of democracy in action, that when you do have a choice for making a decision in government and in politics, you know, there are these things that are in place in case there's a tie or in case things are closed. And sometimes, you know, watching that play out, people may not like it, but that's the rule that's in place. And that's how we, if we witness it on television, then we just see it. You know?
So, David, what will you be looking for then on Election Day?
Well, I study public opinion. I'm mostly interested in specifically how the gender gap is going to play out in this election and what the exit polls show in terms of reasons for voting for one candidate or the other. So I do have, my beliefs about how the thing will turn out. I think Hillary Clinton will win based on the polls and based on some of the state results right now. But I'll be interested to see if they follow through, if there's a late surge or not.
And how about for you, Lorraine?
I'm really concerned about the votes that are lost because the mechanics of election administration don't work. That is, you know, people who wait in line for an hour and they just don't have any more time and they walk away. That's ballots that don't, that don't get counted for some technical reason. There are a lot of reasons why legitimate votes from eligible voters don't get counted. There are probably going to be, you know, several hundred thousand of those. And that's what I'm going to be worried about.
Well, on that note, we usually like to end on a high note, but we'll end on that note. Lorraine Menidi, thank you for coming in. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
And she's a professor of public policy at Rutgers University at their Camden campus, wrote a book called The Myth of Voter Fraud. David Wilson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.
You're welcome. And he's professor of political science and psychological and brain sciences at the University of Delaware. Lots of people that wanted to join the conversation. We can carry on the conversation on our Facebook page. Also send us a tweet as well. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thanks for joining us.